Oh, you're muted again, Madam Examiner.
Okay, thank you, everyone. We're back on the record. Department file number 2202629, appeal hearing concerning the critical area buffer reduction decision. Dr. Rosine, I think we will pick up where we left off with questions from Mr. Teligin.
Okay, thank you so much. So Dr. Rosine, I am showing you, this is, looks like sheet C4.03 of exhibit F15, or I'm sorry, F16, which was identified in the foundational documents as part of the applicant's stormwater plans. Have you reviewed this before?
Yes, I have.
Okay. Were you here earlier for my discussion with Mr. Heacock about stormwater?
I was, yes.
Okay. I'd like to take this time just to get sort of a general overview of the stormwater system in this portion of the Arborwood development. And so in this particular image, I had showed him there were these arrows flowing north, and then these arrows flowing south to a catch basin 64, and then out to the wetland. Can you describe generally what we're seeing there?
Yes, what we're seeing here is just a fairly standard road with essentially no stormwater management for water quality included here. It's what you see here is a road that is crowned to the uphill side, which means that it's all draining towards the uphill slope. Then you can see a swale that's running on the right-hand side of the road, and then it drops to a catch basin, then a series of pipes, and then with direct discharge to the wetland.
Okay, and you said that the road is sloped to the uphill side. In this image, is the uphill side on the right or the left of the road?
It's on the right-hand side, which I believe that is going to be east here. I believe up is north.
Yeah. Right. So there's the key. So north is yeah. up, and then east is on the right hand side. So we have some water flowing along this swale to the catch basin. And then I've actually added this little teeny mark just to remind myself. This is where the arrows shift direction. Right. So sure. South of that, they run down to the catch basin. North of that, they run north. So let's just follow that water up. That water appears to flow through the swale, and it meets up right here. It continues to flow till it gets to this catch basin 59. Do you see that?
I do. Yep. Following you.
And then from there, it goes north into catch basin 56, from catch basin 56 to catch basin 55, and then again out to a discharge out here. Is that similar? Is it the same basic structure, but north of what we were just looking at?
Exactly. It's a direct discharge. No water quality treatment. It's just a pipe and drain.
Okay. And then we have this portion over here. I think this is part of phase five.
This is phase five. Yeah.
Yes, and we have a portion of phase five going into what looks like a stormwater pond over on the east side. Then we also have some other inputs to the stormwater pond. Do you have an opinion on how well that stormwater pond will do at managing stormwater?
Yes, I do. One of the things that's to consider here, I was asked earlier as far as what it was that I had reviewed, you know, as far as requirements, and it appears that the 1997 Kitsap County Stormwater Manual is the relevant stormwater requirements for the time, and as far as I can tell, the project is not remotely in compliance with even the 1997 requirements, because the requirements for 97 are that all the developed areas are drained to a retention pond or something of that style. There's a couple of other options in there, and we have really a fairly small portion of the site, the southern portion of phase five that drains through that retention pond. As we've just showed, all of the spine road drains untreated directly out to a wetland. And then there's one portion of the northern portion of phase five that does drain also to the pond, but it drains to the outlet side of the pond. Yeah, right up there. Exactly. So yeah. If you put stormwater into the outlet end of a pond, you're bypassing all the water quality benefits. So that's what that's doing, is it's just putting it in for quantity management, so for peak flow controls, but it's not providing any water quality benefits. So if you look at the site as a whole, and I know we're not, I know the stormwater management really is not up for debate because this has already been approved, but it really doesn't even meet the 1997 requirements. And there's very little that's been designed here for water quality. You can see
that. We stop right there for just one sure. second, just so we can clarify yeah. for the examiner. When you talk about water being discharged to this particular stormwater pond on the outlet yeah. side, you're referring to this line of catch basins that, at least on this screen, might begin with yep. CB45 to CB44, CB40, yep. and then it wraps around ultimately to this discharge here. Right?
That's correct. Yep.
But your point is that discharge point is on the same side as the outlet.
It's on the same side as the outlet, and it also captures, just to your right there, it captures the northern side of phase five, so CB53 to CB40. So it's taking all of that, and those are all joining in that same run, that pipe run that goes into the outlet end of the of the stormwater pond there. So,
and why does it matter that the input is on the same side as the outlet?
Because for a pond to be effective from a water quality standpoint, so it's important to separate two elements, right? We have quality, which is all about removal of sediment and metals and nutrients and bacteria and other things. And then we have quantity management, which really is about peak flow controls and volumetric controls. So how much water is coming off and how fast is it coming off? By putting water into the tail end or the outlet end of a pond, you're really only getting the volumetric or the peak flow control element.
Right.
For you to get quality element, it has to go in on the inlet side so that it can flow through the vegetation, so that the length of the pond is important for settling. So one of the real basics that we talk about for stormwater management is total suspended solids. It's a pretty rudimentary measure, but it's important because it's sort of a surrogate for a lot of other things. So salt TSS, for example, is highly correlated with metals removal, because metals tend to bind to solids. And so if you have no TSS removal, total suspended solids removal, you're going to have very little metals removal. And so that's really significant in that I haven't done a detailed analysis from this, but it looks to me as if less than 25% of this portion, phase five in the spine road, have any water quality design aspects to it.
Okay. So that we focus a little bit on the pond, but I want to focus on the runoff from the spine road in particular, right? And so we began with the sheet below, looking at the discharge point to what is wetland P2. And also this discharge point going from CB56 out to the discharge point in sort of the northern portion of wetland L2.
Yeah.
From that whole length of road, or actually, let me see, let's go back to the next one down. For, the whole length of road, is there any water quality treatment going on to treat the surface runoff from the road before it enters the wetlands?
Zero, absolutely none on either side. Yeah, and none that goes to the north and none that goes to the south.
Okay. Now, going back to this image, this is again sheet C403 showing wetland P2. There's this feature in the wetland and it says energy dissipator gabion. What is that?
That is... It's simply to slow the water. So it's an energy dissipator. So what that means is the water is going to be rushing out of this pipe. We lose about, I don't remember what the pipe slope is, but pipe slope is fairly steep here. And so the water is going to be traveling really rapidly as it leaves the pipe. And if this were going into a stormwater pond, you wouldn't need a gavion. But without gavions, it's just going to be extremely erosive, and it's going to destroy everything below it. And it's very likely that even with the gavions, it's going to have a tremendous impact. And we can talk about that.
Okay. We'll get to that in a moment.
Yeah.
Now I want to just go back here and zoom in. We have the road here, and then you see we have some dashed lines. Are those elevation lines, correct?
Yeah, those are the existing topography. That's correct. Yeah.
Existing topography. And then we have some gray solid lines cutting across them. What's your understanding of those gray solid lines?
Yeah, those are the proposed contours, or the proposed grading in this case.
I see. And viewing this image, or viewing this sheet, what's your understanding of the general nature of that proposed grading in that area?
Right. So we're really transforming the hillside here. We've got approximately 15 feet of fill that's being added. We have a natural slope that's coming in at around a 13%. So a steep hillside, but not crazy. But the new slope from that edge of road to the TOA slope is a little over 65%, or right around 65%. So it's arguable that you'll even be able to revegetate that hillside. It will take some significant efforts. You know, it's greater than a one-to-one slope. It's not vertical, but it's greater than a one-to-one slope. So it's going to be a challenge. It's going to take some effort.
Let me take the driver's seat here for a second. So we have, you said, around 15 feet of fill, give or take. They are recontouring that slope down towards P2. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah.
And then they have a direct discharge to P2, correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay. Now I want to go back and talk about the swale. You said it is untreated. Why do you say that?
Right. So this is an important distinction here. Where it says swale, we cannot confuse that with what's often referred to in the language of BMPs, or best management practices, as a treatment swale, or a water quality swale, or a wet swale, or a dry swale. There's the terminology here, swale, is a little misleading in that it's really a roadside ditch, because for it to be And we can look at the Kitsap County Stormwater Manual for this, but for it to be considered a water quality swale, there are certain dimensions and slopes and widths and et cetera that have to occur, so that the prior things that I had mentioned, which are settling and filtration, can actually occur. None of that has been done here. And how do we know that? The stormwater report states very simply in their stormwater report that the site has been designed for water quality simply through the use of ponds. So ponds are the only thing they're offering for water quality treatment, and that they don't make reference to water quality swales or biofiltration systems or anything of that type.
Sure. So this was submitted as Exhibit R19. As a storm drainage report. Have you reviewed this document?
I have, but what I'm seeing right now is still your stormwater plan.
How about there. Now?
Yes, I have reviewed this.
Okay. So this was submitted by Taylor Morrison, the developer, as the storm drainage report for this project. And you did review this document.
I did, yeah.
Was there any indication in this document that the swale on the east side of the Spine Road is intended as a water quality treatment facility, or to have water quality treatment properties to it?
No. And you can find that statement on, it's section 4.6 for water quality.
Section 4.6?
Yeah, 4.6.
Or do you mean page 4.6?
Maybe it's page 4.6. Yeah, there we go.
Doesn't look like that's it. three,
almost.
Four. Oh, there we go. There's section 4.6.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's page 4-14. So what is it about this page that tells you that the swale will not have water quality treatment?
If you read this section, it's just really that they talk about, the first general paragraph there says that the water quality design for the site is in the form of wet ponds. And there's a wet pond for phase four. There's a wet pond for phase five. There's no mention of water quality swales. And they cite incompletely the Kitsap County stormwater design manual. So it does say 6 month, 24 hour storm. But what it also says in there, 6 month, 24 hour storm for all developed areas and all contributing areas. As I said earlier, I haven't done an exhaustive look at this, but from what I can tell from phase five and the spine road here, it's probably 25% of the developed area. And I don't actually know what the contributing area is at this point. But so my point being that it's nowhere near the Kitsap County requirements for the 1997 requirements. It's nowhere near it.
Okay. Which they can go back to the, oh, there it is. So we've talked about the swale. We've talked about the discharges. And then what is this feature? I'm back on their stormwater plans. There's this sort of feature on the east side of the road.
That's a retaining wall. So you have a steep slope there, and it's necessary to just hold up the hillside so that they can build this, so that they can route water through this roadside ditch and then into the closed pipe system. So without that, a more traditional design would be a crowned road in the center, which means that it drains to the left and the right. And then they would need to curb it, which is, you know, the use of a swale is a much easier design feature.
Okay. And now this swale is going to be collecting road runoff. What kind of pollutants do you generally find in road runoff?
The most common ones that we talk about would be total suspended solids. So that's just essentially sands and gravels and silts and clays and any stuff that's ground off of traffic vehicles and the roads themselves. So we have TSS, we have nutrients, so nitrogen and phosphorus. We have metals, zinc, copper. And then we also have of significance in the Northwest is our contaminants that are known to affect salmon, which are metals in particular, like copper and the derivative, one of the derivatives that comes out of tire rubber, which is, I can't remember what that's called, 6-QPD or something like that. Mm-hmm. But it's a tire derivative that's extremely toxic. To fish.
Mm-hmm. And are these pollutants that are generally good or bad for wetland environments?
Yeah, they're all bad news for wetlands. So aquatic habitat is heavily impacted by a number of things. So it's going to be both, we're on the topic of quality, but we'll need to move to the topic of the hydrology. But in mm-hmm. terms of water quality, these are sensitive ecosystems. And we would expect, for example, in this case, that we would have, you know, we're adding about 1.1 acres of impervious area, so roadways. 1.1 acres of roadway, and this would add an estimated 272 pounds of total suspended solids annually, 4.2 pounds of total nitrogen, 0.3 pounds of total phosphorus, and 0.1 pounds of total zinc annually that you would expect from this roadway.
And how'd you come up with those numbers?
They're sort of standard numbers for pollutant load export rates. Yeah, and they're generally defined as a pounds per acre per year, and then we would often do this if these systems were designed for water quality, that we would then take those numbers and we would apply a removal efficiency or some sort of treatment function of that BMP, And in this instance, as I've said, this is a direct discharge. There is no treatment function for these swales that's published. So we wouldn't apply any treatment removal for this. It would only be after if it had been treated by a pond or a biofiltration system or a water quality swale that we would apply some sort of reduction value to that.
Okay. So when I was talking to Mr. Heacock, I pointed out to him that the code in effect at the time that this project vested, one of the criteria for getting an approval of a buffer averaging plan was that the buffer averaging would have no adverse impact on the wetland. Okay. Would stormwater coming out of this particular discharge, would you expect that to have an adverse impact on water quality within the wetland?
Yes, absolutely.
In the documents that you've reviewed for this project, did you see any analysis of what that impact might be?
No, I did not. And I think one of the points to mention here is that why this is so significant, why the role of buffers is so significant is even though we're not debating the approved stormwater management approach for the site, because that's already vested, it's already approved. But because it's such a low quality for overall water quality performance, not even meeting the 1997 standards, the wetlands are going to be incredibly reliant here on the buffers for water quality treatment. And so the buffers in this instance are extremely important, far more so than they probably would be if this particular project had high end stormwater management. So for that reason, I think the idea here of no adverse impact is there will certainly be adverse impacts and for a lot of reasons.
Let's go on to some more of those. Let's talk about water quantity, not necessarily the quality of the water, but the amount of it. What would you expect there to be more water coming out of that gabion in this image than currently is flowing into the wetland over the surface?
Yeah, immensely. Right. So I think, again, I haven't done a detailed hydrologic analysis of this, but from what I understand, the drainage area, and this was from the stormwater report, the drainage area to this particular location has increased dramatically. And why that is because you're funneling water from, I don't remember the length of road here, but it's a pretty substantial length of road. You're funneling all the water from this length of road to a single point, as opposed to it slowly weeping down the hillside. So what this wetland itself is experiencing now is a tremendous increase. I mean, this cannot be understated, a tremendous increase in the volume and the duration, I'm sorry, and the peak. And the hydro period of a wetland is exceptionally important. We talked about a slope wetland, and why this is important. So a slope wetland is a very common feature. It happens usually when you have a steep hillside that either comes into sort of a corner, where a left and a right face might meet, or when you have a change of slope where it goes from steep to shallow. The soil reports for this area are telling us that the typical depth to water here is anywhere between 11 and 24 inches. And so what that means is that as soon as the hillside begins to shallow out, the water's coming to the surface and it flows very slowly through this, right? So you might expect this to come through at a rate of about a foot per day is what the water would be moving across this a slope wetland. With the velocity coming out of this pipe, you might expect it to be closer to 15 feet per second, 15 feet per second, as opposed to, as I said, maybe a foot per day. And looking at the soil types here, we have We had the soil types here. There was a, I can't remember the soil. It was a gravelly ashy loam, if I remember. Yeah, here it is. It's Kapausen gravelly ashy loam. And by the USDA soil erodibility index, this is in the mid to upper mid range for erodibility, which means it has the potential to erode over time when it's exposed to high velocity flows. In its current condition, it's never exposed to high velocity flows ever. It's just seeping out of the hillside. So you can imagine a situation that the way this is designed over a short period of time, we would expect erosion to occur, a channel to form, and this wetland to completely change. And why would it change? Because if this channel cuts down, let's just say it cuts 2 or 3 feet, you've now lowered the water table in that wetland by 2 or 3 feet. 2 or 3 feet could be a conservative amount here. It could be a lot more than that. These are fairly well-known phenomena. This happens out at the end of culverts, below roads. And, you know, we often hear about head cuts or channel cuts that can extend 10, 20 feet. I have no idea what it would be here. That would take a real analysis to figure it out. But what that does is all of the vegetation in that wetland is currently fed by a sloped hillside where it gets inundated. If you now have a cut in the middle of it, you're going to lower the water table and all that wetland vegetation is going to dry up. It's a very well known phenomena that, and it's one of the reasons why channel protection is an important part of modern day stormwater management. And there's no channel protection, zero being offered here. An energy dissipator is old school channel protection, but it really doesn't. It's going to slow the water down, but it's not going to change the duration of it.
Mm-hmm. And so would those be, in your opinion, adverse impacts to the wetland?
Well, yeah, absolutely. It will completely change the wetland. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Now I want to go back. And so that's talked a little bit about surface flow to the wetland in terms of water quality and then also water quantity, both of which would come with adverse impacts. Tell me though about the fill material they're putting in. First of all, do you have an understanding of what the purpose is of that fill material?
Yeah. And here, so yeah, I mean, yeah.
Sorry, just to clarify one more thing, sure. For the examiner, I'm talking about, we spoke about these solid contour lines of regrading the fill. So do you have an understanding, Dr. Rosine, of what that's for?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. So what we have here is just, it's a pretty normal conflict of goals. And we this happens all the time in advanced stormwater management. Anytime we're dealing with infiltration, we have this conflict. It happens in bioretention systems and permeable pavements. And so what it is we for this road to be built, they're going to have to cut out the soil, all that soil structure that we talked about earlier that has high infiltration rates. We're going to have to place a structural fill and we're going to have to compact it. That's going to destroy all of the soil structure very intentionally because we're building a road on this. So essentially what we're doing here is we're adding 10 to 15 feet of fill, and we're creating what's going to be a dam because this is highly compacted material. It's not truly a dam because there's not an impermeable barrier in the middle of it, but it becomes effectively a very low porosity system when it's done. And so what this is going to do is water that had previously flowed down this hillside from way upslope, that's shallow groundwater. You remember where we talked about a surface wetland or a slope wetland. That's because we know the water is coming through this slope, you know, in a pre-development condition, somewhere between 11 and 24 inches below ground surface. The earlier woman who testified, what's one of her test bits, she showed it at 4 inches below ground surface. So on the slope, we'd expect it probably a little bit further down than that. The soil, the fill material on this is going to basically cut off shallow surface water flow. And why that is because you have to drive that compaction into the subsurface for this fill material to be structurally stable to build a road on that. If you did not, you would have a slope that would slough or road that would settle over time. And so what that does is it's going to affect the shallow groundwater feed that is the routine water source for this gravel or for this surface wetland. And so what you're doing is you're dramatically changing the hydroperiod. Imagine it now. You have a surface wetland system that is fed little by little all year round. You know, maybe it dries out a little bit during a period of time during the dry summer months, but it's basically slowly, flowing down the hillside, feeding the system. Now you're going to have a system that's going to have much of that flow is going to be cut off because of that compacted surface slope. And now you're just going to feed it like a fire hose just during the rains. Okay. So that wetland hydrology is going to change completely for the surface wetland, the slope wetland. There's no question about it.
Right.
There's zero. I mean, if we had a spring or we had an intermittent stream that was feeding this, we'd have a different conclusion. But because this is a slope fed wetland, you're cutting it off with the fill and you're now feeding it with a fire hose. So what is now a wetland is going to become an intermittent stream.
And so this, which we're talking about subsurface flow coming from, say, over in this area to the east of the road, you know, that would naturally flow down into the wetland being cut off by this sort of compacted road material in the fill, correct?
That's right.
This is also a retaining wall. What happens to the water when it hits the retaining wall? Are there normally collection units at the bottoms of those structures?
Yeah, that's right. So what a retaining wall, so that it doesn't collapse, will be backfilled with a drainage stone and have drain pipes at the bottom of it. So you'll have weep holes at the bottom. And that's good. And that, remember what I told you, we have antagonistic design needs here. We have the need for structural stability, but we also have the impacts with respect to groundwater recharge. So yeah, that wall is going to intersect groundwater flow. So you're going to have the deeper groundwater flow, and that'll probably get down to L2. But this surface wetland is for sure going to be impacted by the surficial materials, the surficial water level that we know to be very shallow.
Okay. So now we've talked about sort of subsurface flows being choked off or dammed by the road material. We've talked about the surface discharge via this gabion right here. Now I want to talk about the slope of this fill material. Now, I was talking to Mr. Heacock, he seemed to acknowledge that slope does play a role in the functionality of a wetland buffer. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah. So, can I opine beyond slope here?
Yes, you may.
Okay. So, first item is that buffers in general, when we talk about buffers, that we generally refer to them as undisturbed areas. So this idea of temporary disturbance is in my professional experience is unusual, right? And why is that? Because a buffer it has many functions, but
I'm going to object to this testimony. The scope of this testimony is limited to stormwater management and wetlands, not to opine on the role of wetland buffers.
I will sustain that because I do think that was covered on your voir dire, and I do believe that the witness was clear on the scope of what he was testifying on. So I will sustain that.
I'm sorry, but Mr. Rosine, don't you need to think about how to protect wetlands when you're thinking about stormwater impacts on wetlands?
Buffers are absolutely a stormwater management element. So to separate buffers from stormwater is not the case. It's in the stormwater manuals for that matter. So it's relevant here.
Well, he can speak to the issue of stormwaters, but he can't speak to the issue of what a wetland buffer's functionality provides. He's not a wetland expert.
Yeah, he is a stormwater expert, and we've already established that buffers, part of their function is to control stormwater. And Mr. Rosine has testified that their purpose is that, and that's within his scope of expertise.
Well, then please limit the questions to the issue of stormwater impacts, and that's it.
That's what I thought I was doing.
And that's actually what I was trying to say. The I'm not going to opine on the habitat fact functions or anything, really, just from a water quality standpoint and a quantity management standpoint. So there are plenty of stormwater manuals around the country that actually have design aspects for how you design buffers. And generally speaking, there's four elements to it. There's distance, there's slope, there's vegetative cover, and soils. I'm sorry, I realize I'm speaking fast. I'll repeat that. So thanks. Distance refers to the distance that the water has to travel through the buffer. Slope refers to the slope of the surface, and why that's important is because that's going to the steepness of the slope affects the rate or how fast the water is going to travel down that slope. So velocity is really, really important. Vegetation or vegetative cover is another really important aspect. And the density of vegetation, the thickness of the root mat, the microtopography that exists in an undisturbed buffer, these are essential elements to the water quality and the stormwater management benefits of a buffer. An undisturbed landscape has all of these elements that slow the water as they move through it and allow for infiltration to occur. And then the last aspect that we've talked about several times is the role of soils. And that's why I think this idea of a temporary disturbance, actually all these elements, but in particular soils as it relates to the temporary disturbance, you have structural soils that are being compacted that really lose their infiltration capacity at the end of this. So what we have here is, as I mentioned, we have a couple of things that are happening for distance. The first one is that we have... before we were talking about buffer averaging, we had a 200 foot vegetative buffer, undisturbed vegetative buffer. We're now cutting that to 100 feet, supposedly cutting that to 100 feet, but there's actually disturbance up to about 65 feet. And then we have the other factor, which is, I'm not even sure how this really factors in, but distance almost plays no role when we have a direct discharge. Because the buffer, a lot of the protective benefit of the buffer is eliminated through the direct discharge. But so distance is really important. So slope, the prior slope that we had, the existing conditions is a 13% slope. We're proposing a 65% slope. So if this were just a normal channel, which it's not, but we would be increasing our velocity from about a 21 feet per second to about 49 feet per second. So more than doubling of the runoff rate coming down this slope.
So let me ask you this. Overall, chopping this buffer down to 100 feet, building a two-lane road through it, bringing in, well, by the way, before I move on, do you have any estimate for how much fill you see in this image? Like how much fill is involved?
I do not.
Is it a lot?
It's a lot of material, right? We know at the top it's over 10 feet of material. I'd hate to even guess, but let's say it's a couple thousand yards of material probably.
Yeah. So a couple thousand yards of compacted fill material, roadbed, a direct discharge to the wetland from the roadside ditch. Is there any way that you can imagine that this would not have an adverse impact on this wetland?
Yeah, no way I can imagine at all. There's so many important things to consider here. And I think that, you know, if we categorize them in two very large categories, the first one is that we have a large amount, a little over an acre's worth of roadway that is untreated with a direct discharge to the wetland. So that alone would constitute an enormous impact on from my perspective. But then the other really important aspect here is the road construction and what that's going to do to what we would refer to as the hydro period or the hydrology of this wetland. And those two elements combine, the fact that, you know, what creates a wetland? We know it's The one thing that causes the creation of a wetland is hydrology. The soils and the vegetation follow. They're essential ingredients. You don't have a wetland without hydric soils. You don't have a wetland without wetland vegetation. But if you don't have hydrology, you've got none of that. And so you're changing the foundational element to the formation to the existence of this wetland here. And so I think there's no question about it that there will be a significant adverse impacts in my opinion here.
And then one last question, Dr. Rosin, go back to the staff report in this case. This is Mr. Hecox's staff report, and in conditions said, he says, permit application approval is subject to chapter 19-200-215 and 19-300-315 of the Kitsap County Code, which states that buffers or setbacks shall remain undisturbed natural vegetation areas, except when the buffer can be enhanced to improve its functional attributes. None of this is obviously enhancing it, but they're going to replant it. They're going to do all this, build the road, and then replant that fill.
Yeah. There's no way.
Is that going to enhance it?
Yeah, there's no way. Remember, we talked about four elements. There's slope, vegetation, soils, and what was slope? Oh, distance. And the only thing that's being restored in this case is vegetation, right? So you can't restore a compacted soil. Pedogenesis is the process of soil formation, and it takes thousands of years to get soil structure going. So you're not restoring the soils. The vegetation you can plant, but you can't really replace, several hundred year old soil root mat, duff, all the microtopography that goes with it. So you're gonna have a microtopography that's lost by just running a bulldozer across it and reestablishing it. You're not going to have this gentle undulating landscape that captures a lot of water. And then the slope, of course, as I said, the slope is we're more than doubling the runoff velocity associated with this slope.
One last set of questions. So I asked Mr. Hecox about this too. It sounded like he hadn't done any review of it yet. But in our case, the developer was going to reduce the 200-foot buffer to 85 feet. Then we pointed out that that's not allowed. And now they want to do it to 100 feet. They want approval for that. Here is the diagram that they submitted with their response to my motion for summary judgment on this topic, where they're showing that they are, moving the central line of the road back 15 feet. They still have fill. They still have the road. They don't show it here. The actual discharge, but they do show the arrows going to that same catch basin location, right? So presumably their recent stormwater plans are still accurate. They're going to discharge, moving it back 15 feet, but keeping everything else the same. Is that going to wipe away these impacts, or are we still going to expect to see an adverse impact to this wetland?
Yeah, I think you would still expect to see an adverse impact, and I would argue that the location of where the buffer is delineated here is incorrect, that the edge of the buffer is the edge of the disturbance area, right? So this idea of temporary disturbance, I didn't see anywhere in the code that allows for temporary disturbance. I saw wetland buffers refer to undisturbed areas. That's what I was reading. I don't remember seeing anything that allows for temporary. So I think that the actual buffer is probably more like 50 feet off of the of the wetland, wherever that line is. I don't know what the dimension on that is, but you see an 85 dimension, and it looks like it's probably at about 55 would be the actual limit of undisturbed buffer.
Right. I mean, the fill material goes closer than 85 feet.
Yeah, that's correct. And that's because, remember, slope, soils, and vegetation.
Okay.
Right? Those, you can't restore those.
All right. I mean, are there any impacts? Are there any impacts from this buffer modification that we haven't discussed today, do you think are relevant?
I do. I think one other important one is so often in Washington State, what we're quite concerned about the fisheries, and stormwater ponds are old school stormwater management, and they're known for their thermal impacts. They elevate in the summertime; they superheat water. In the wintertime, they overcool water. So they add a greater extreme to the thermal impacts of runoff. And so I want to reiterate the issue, because the stormwater management overall at this site is really fairly poor. The protective value of buffers here cannot be overstated. And they're really needed. And if you think about what's happening with P2 here, we have more water than it's used to seeing going to be added, like a phenomenal amount of additional water. I haven't calculated that, but it's got to be three or four times the volume. I'm sure of it. So that one's getting more water, but then L2, the unique part about L2 is that this is a wetland that's fed from the south flowing to the north. So the top of the wetland is basically below, I mean, it's not exactly the top, but it's about where P2 comes in. So the bottom of the wetland before it flows out is on the north end, closer to where the stormwater pond discharges. So the fact that we're routing all this water from this hillside, there you go. The fact that we're routing all this water from the hillside to the very bottom, or the outlet end of L2, tells me that we're going to have this project as a whole is going to have a big impact on L2, because you can't just put water at the end of the system and think it's going to backfeed everything. You have over 1,000 feet of this wetland that is not going to receive the same amount of water that it would have prior to this development. There should be outlets periodically. I mean, they talk about dispersion in here, but I don't really see dispersion. I see single outlet points. There should be outlets along the way that continue to feed the wetland so that we don't change the wetland functionality here. And what you could sort of imagine over time is that L2 is going to shrink at the bottom of this, where the water's being reduced, and it's going to expand probably on the top where it's being fed. Mm-hmm. Sorry, not on the top, but on the northern side here.
Yeah, and you reminded me, I did have one more question about the tease off of that. I'm going to go back to one of the images that was in the staff report. This is page 5 of the staff report. And we've been talking a lot about this area to the east of wetland P2 that's being taken away. Well, it looks, because it's the only other place that touches the buffer, this blue area is where they're adding buffer to compensate. Right. To compensate for that impact, right?
Right.
And so now if we go back to the stormwater diagram that we've been just looking at.
This is an important point. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're taking away this area, building the road, direct discharge, thousands of, you know, pounds or tons of compacted fill material. And then they're adding this area right here.
Yeah.
Will that compensate for those impacts?
This has zero bearing on the protective aspect of buffers. Now, there are situations where the addition of buffer would be really important, but this is not one of them. If you zoom in, you can see that there's a retaining wall right there. So no runoff is working its way down there anyhow. And the internal grading on these lots, you can see CB37 is an example right there on the corner. This development is going to be drained internally and all flow to the north. From a water quality standpoint, for a buffer addition to be protective, you'd have to be eliminating pollutant load that would otherwise be reaching that. So that is to say where that addition is, there's no pollutant load that's reaching L2 that's coming through that area. Where if you might recall, I cited some numbers about the pollutant load addition down there. There's no equivalent load that's coming in P2 that's going to be offset in this other one up here. So while it has some habitat benefits, which I'm not really opine on here, it has no water quality or quantity benefits at all. So from my standpoint, from the buffer averaging as it relates to adverse impacts, it's of no value.
Thank you so much. I have no further questions.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Rosine. At this time, we'll see about cross-examination. Mr. Getchis, do you want to go first or Ms. Liao?
I have a lot of questions. David, do you want to go first?
You can still go first. I'm still thinking about a couple of questions.
Sure, I'm happy to. This might take me a bit as I need to pull up various materials so everyone can bear with me. Let me go back up here.
Mind if we take since Ms. Liao is pulling things up, do I have to get a 2-minute break so I can?
Yeah, I think that might be good. I was just wondering, thinking about the 2-hour approximate time limit that we have on recording. If we take a couple minute break, then we should be good, I hope, to get all the way to the end. Okay, at least for the day.
Yep.
All right. 5 minutes, please.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.